Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have a special guest this week in Marcus Padley, a long-serving stockbroker who now heads up the investment newsletter Marcus Today, which has been running for over 20 years. Marcus has won awards for applied portfolio management and is a master member of the Stockbrokers Association of Australia. And he is also regularly out on the speaking circuit in the industry, sharing his viewpoints and experience. He comes on the show today to give his insights and reasoning behind a recent bullish call on the state of the Australian share market and provide a bit of background into his thoughts on that call.
So today we've got Marcus Padley from the Marcus Today newsletter and also runs some funds, and he has and a financial planner as well. So we're going to talk to him about a number of things. The key one is he wrote a piece talking about how he's gone all in on the stock market. Now, before we get into the conversation, I just want to preface this by saying Marcus is a very active trader. He runs a newsletter and is an ex-stockbroker. And so he's sort of playing the market very much from a feel and a technical perspective, and so which is very different to how we do things at Nucleus. But we thought having these types of conversations with traders and people who are quite active in the market is always useful. It's always good to challenge your own views. As most regular listeners will know, we went to cash bonds, government bonds, and it's particularly international cash over the last 2 months, and that's been very good for us in terms of our performance has basically been flat in our growth fund over a period in which markets are down sort of 25 to 30%. Marcus sort of approached it from a different direction. I think he's come from being quite fully invested to flipping to lots of cash very early in the crisis, and now he's turned back to going very bullish. And so we really wanted to get in behind his reasons for going bullish and sort of challenge our own views as to whether now is the time to be bullish or whether it's just time to wait.
And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, and follow us on your preferred podcast platform. I hope you enjoy. Today on the show, we have Chief Editor of the popular investment newsletter Marcus Today, Marcus Padley. Welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Hi, good morning.
Great to have you. So to get the ball rolling, we'd like to, just if you wouldn't mind providing a brief background on yourself and your journey with Marcus Today, please, Marcus.
Yes, I've been a stockbroker since 1982, I think. So I was on the stock market, London stock market, for 16 years, talking to international clients. Came over to Australia, carried on talking to institutional clients, and went into retail broking with Bell Potter after ABN AMRO closed their institutional desk in Australia. And I was with sitting next to Andrew Bell, and I've been told that the research department at Bell Potter was the core of their business. As it turned out in those days, there were a couple of chaps in Sydney who would write corporate research, and that was about it. So I found myself talking to retail investors with an institutional background, and felt that the research wasn't quite what I was used to, and started realizing I'd better write my own ideas to clients. I only had one, which was my brother-in-law, but I discovered the BCC box on Microsoft Outlook, which in those days was high technology, and realized I could send emails to more than one person without them seeing how many I had. And so my brother-in-law thought I had thousands of clients as I sent him these ideas in the morning. I only had one, but within a couple of years, I had a couple of thousand people. The subject line of my first email to Mace, my brother-in-law, was Marcus's ideas today. Today's ideas from Marcus. Marcus's today. And I just wrote Marcus Today in capitals, and the newsletter was born. So I've been writing a newsletter since over 20 years now, since 1998. And that spawned a database from which I've built a financial planning business, and a funds management business and an education business. And here I am 20 years later with a team of 25 writing the Marcus Today newsletter.
Well done. Yeah, that's a terrific journey. So I guess moving on from here, and just to get the conversation started, there's obviously plenty of opinions in on the direction of the stock markets, as we've seen with this incredibly volatile time. And I guess the beginnings of today, or the reason for today, was that you've recently come out with a bull case for your fund and your readership. And so I thought maybe if we'd like to start by expanding on that a little bit, and then we can sort of roll into some conversation with the rest of the team.
Yep. We have lucked out in this correction. But it has come out of our experience over the September 2018 correction, when the market fell 15%, our fund fell 23%. So we underperformed significantly, and we learned some hard lessons there. That left us in September last year, when trade talks looked like they were going to fold up. We saw all the signs that I have seen before, from anywhere from 1987 to the GFC, of a potential precipitous collapse in the market. We went to 100% cash. As it was, that turned out to be a little bit premature. We mildly underperformed and got fully invested again as the market continued to perform. But we have spent the last year feeling that the market is overpriced. There's a very large Trump factor, which has created the S&P 500 PE of 23.5 times, which I felt was a bit silly. There is $27 billion worth of stocks in the US that were trading at 23.5 times. Now, if you came into the real world and offered any private business owner 23 times last year's earnings for their business, you would be knocked over in the rush to accept. Here you had $27 billion worth of US stocks trading at this price, which was floated on a president who clearly saw the stock market as a barometer of his success, had driven the market with confidence rather than competence, in our opinion. And then we were watching the charts as well. And you can see the beginnings. Corrections always start fast. And you have to be decisive very early on when they start. And so when things came around this time, we were fully invested, constantly expressing our skepticism about the market price. When the COVID collapse started on the 20th, I think it was, the Thursday, by Monday, we were in 45% cash. We'd gone to 100% cash before. We were prepared to do it again. By the middle of that week, we were 65% cash. A week later, we were 70% cash. And in the last few days, we felt the sentiment changing again, and as a nimble fund, we're running about $35 million. As a nimble fund, we just went all in again, and the net result is when the market's down 28%, we're now down just, well, the market, our market's going to open up today, but we're down 6.1%. And have outperformed about 23% in a month. Some fund managers will celebrate at the end of a year when they've outperformed their accumulation index benchmark by 1%, and we've outperformed by 23% in a month. These are extraordinary times. We've lucked out with our timing because there's been a lot of guesswork involved in that. But I like to think after the hard lessons we've had, there was a little bit of skill involved.
Yeah, thanks. I might jump in if I can, Tim.
Go on, Damon.
There's some great performance. And I think it probably sounds pretty similar to where we've got a bunch. I guess we've got different assets that we run. We sort of run international plus Aussie plus bonds and cash. And it just gives us a few more levers to play with, I guess, in terms of our exposure. I guess we've sort of followed very much a similar path in terms of that whole market very much overvalued. Whether you look at, I guess that must be 23 times prior year earnings. We look a lot at both that, but also the next year's earnings. But I guess one of the key things we were looking at was saying, well, markets could fall sort of about 20 to 25% just to bring them back to average in terms of the valuation. And so, and that's before earnings even get hit. And so we have seen a big hit to earnings. Sorry, we haven't even seen the big hit to earnings yet because, you know, it's only been 3 weeks in. You know, companies haven't had time to report. I guess, are you trying to play a bear market rally here in terms of a sentiment? Or have you got a view that earnings won't be hit and you know, it's a valuation? You know, we're roughly at longer term average or a little bit below on valuation. So now's the time to buy?
No, I'm not taking a strong view about anything. I reckon the mistake everyone's making at the moment, and you can see it if you like me are stuck in isolation watching Bloomberg or Sky News or CNBC, you'll realize a lot of financial experts, in inverted commas, have turned into medical experts. And they keep telling you these incredulous exponential curves. And do you realize that then give you some medical fact? Truth of the matter is if there is a spectrum at the moment which goes from super bull to super bear. And the super bears, it's always the people at the extremes that are the most vocal. So if Nucleus Wealth writes an article about your view, you will find the extremes start putting comments at the bottom. And usually the people that disagree with you most. Now, these people are just on the spectrum. And there, as I say, there's a spectrum goes from super bear to super bull. And a lot of financial people think they have to take a view on COVID-19 with no skills to do that, just from whatever they've picked up on in articles and TV and CNBC. We shouldn't take a view, but people are taking a view. Our job, I think, as fund managers, if you're trying to do timing, which short term we're forced into this, and it for us it's worked. I'm sure for others it's been disastrous. So we've lucked out a bit. But you have to, our job is to stand Spock-like, applying logic, not emotion, not taking a strong view, and watching the spectrum and watching how the spectrum's moving. You can't be part of the headless chickens and make the right decisions. You have to be watching the headless chickens. And so I've tried to stand with my team every morning objectively and look at what the market sentiment is doing, which is the only thing we've got a skill to do. We're not medical experts. We're trying to ignore the medical scaremongering and to simply look at what we know, which is market sentiment. And in these sort of times, it was obvious to us that the market had a GFC-style correction. Some of the banks down 56%, and then suddenly the Italian market started to bottom. The German market started to bottom. Boeing started to bottom. The VIX volatility index started to top out. The Australian dollar, which is a barometer of this whole debacle, it's a barometer of global economic growth, that started to bottom out as well. And yet the S&P 500 and the ASX 200 hadn't. We just thought it's going to, that moment is coming. So I don't see this as, and we got stuck in hard. And it's worked. But I now continue. I've got no view on COVID-19. We are utterly prepared to go to 100% cash tomorrow if we need to. The best we can do is wake up in this uncertainty, make decisions every morning. There is no playbook for this historic moment in the market. So no, I don't have a view. And I would be careful of listening to any financial person who does have a view, because they really don't know. And if they take a view, they pin themselves to a point on the spectrum, and their investors have to wear their stubbornness and their faith, and that is no basis for investment. So we continue to watch the spectrum, and I don't know what's going to happen next, but I can gauge market sentiment, and that's all I'm doing.
Yeah, sure. And I think that's probably, I mean, I guess where I'm coming from, we have a, because we're running, I guess, broader asset, we're not just either equities. So you can invest in Australian equities or cash, isn't it? That's your two choices?
Yeah, that's it. I can invest in Aussie equity, anything listed on the ASX or cash.
Yeah. Okay. So just to put that in perspective, we've got, so we're basically only large caps, international and Aussie. So we're like the top 70 Aussie stocks, basically. government bonds and cash. And when it's cash, we can do international. And so that's where we've sort of come from. The perspective is we sort of tried to set up a portfolio that we're hedged in different directions. And so as the market's been bouncing sort of 10% up, 10% down, 10% up, our portfolio has basically gone, you know, up 0.5%, down 0.5%. So we're roughly flat over the whole sort of 2 months in terms of our performance. But I guess,
so have you guys gone to cash or have you gone into bonds?
Both. So we've got heavy international cash, and we've got lots of bonds, mostly at the long end of the bond curve. So and we did this at sort of the end of January, start of February. So we got the much higher prices that sort of meant that, you know, the bonds gave us a 10% lift, and the international cash gave us another 10% lift. So we've got our minimum equity holding, say in our growth portfolio, is 30%. So we still had to, you know, obviously fight against that and offset the losses on those. But we.
So what drove you to do that?
So where we've come from is looking at very much the we were quite early in terms of looking at what was happening in China. And so there's two parts of it. One was we could see the supply shock coming and we could see the demand shock coming, and we could see the cases that were caught. We were very focused on the cases that were caught outside China as opposed to the cases exported from China to other countries. And we could just see those cases doubling every 3 or 4 days. And that was where we were sort of saying, well, look, there's a potential for pandemic. We weren't certainly saying this is our base case, but we were saying there's a supply shock coming, there's a demand shock coming. And I guess that's where I push back. I understand what you're saying, that nobody knows where this is and nobody wants to be nobody wants to hold themselves out to be a medical expert if they're not. But for me, the bigger issue for markets, there is a health issue, but the bigger issue is the shutdowns. And I think from our perspective, we're happy to take a view on what the economic impacts are going to be of the shutdowns and what that's going to mean for company earnings. To a certain extent, I don't think you can put a direct number on this, but I guess we're sort of putting our finger in the air and saying, well, look, we knew when the market was 20%, 30% overvalued and earnings had already topped out, that there's an earnings shock coming. And so we're fine. We don't care if we're not in the market because, you know, there's lots of downside. Now we've sort of had that 20, 30% fall. And so we're going, well, we're back to sort of longer term averages now, but we really still haven't seen the earnings effect. And so that's where we're sort of, I can certainly see there's a bear market rally and you'll see these from time to time, but it just seems to me, it seems very premature to say there's a big crisis coming. Governments have thrown lots of money at it. There's unemployment and a whole bunch of other factors we'll get into in a minute, but it's all over in 3 weeks and now the market will start rising from now. So I understand what you're doing in terms of trying to trade it, but I guess I'd say that there are parts you can make. While we can't make medical assessments, we can make financial assessments. Well, that's what we think we're being paid to do anyway, is make financial assessments, and we think that there are still big issues from that coming on.
So Marcus, I mean, given you see your role, you know, kind of external to the virus itself, how do you account for scenarios where the pandemic worsens? And for instance, you know, we're seeing some of those parabolic curves play out now in very large economies like the US. So how do you account for that or discount for that in your thinking?
I wake up every morning and make decisions. That's all I can say. I think forecasting in this environment is not something you can do accurately. None of us know whether this is going to blow over in 3 weeks or whether it's going to last for 6 months and whether Chinese cases are going to re-emerge and then suddenly we've got another kick along and the markets collapse again. It's just unknown. So we have to make decisions, as I tell my team, we chat every morning and make decisions every morning on what's happened in the past. So I'm not trying to quantify anything. I am watching and reading. The core observation is the number of cases. I think Italy will lead us out. If Italy starts to get on top of this, market sentiment will be significantly improved. and looking at the WHO website. And there are Christopher Joy's got a lovely article on Livewire where he's built a model monitoring the exponential curves, and he's predicting that peak cases in the US and Australia will be mid-April, early to mid-April. Well, it's only a couple of weeks away, I think. So just taking it all on board, that sort of message is feeding into market sentiment at the moment, and clearly what people are relying on. That could change tomorrow. So you cannot quantify it. You cannot purport to analyze COVID-19 and its impact on earnings. You do not know whether Webjet or Cochlear earnings are going to be X or Y. I've got models that look at whether stocks are cheap or expensive. They might as well all go in the bin at the moment, because we don't know what the earnings are going to be, and they're based on Reuters consensus forecast for the next 4 years. Well, they're all wrong. So we are in a world of the unknown, and there's no good trying to put a structure of valuation around it, because value's unknown. Almost all valuations in the Australian stock market and the US stock market are based on earnings. The earnings are up in the air. So we are just playing market sentiment. And as I say, I'll wake up in the morning and I understand that in bear markets, the biggest rallies happen. We've just had a 23% rally in the Dow Jones in 3 days. The biggest rallies happen in a bear market. We're still in a bear market. No one's calling the bottom. But if it looks like we're taking another leg down, we will be out like Flynn, just as we got in.
So do you make macro assessments at all? I, as Damien was intimating, rather than necessarily following the virus, we've drawn certain political conclusions about how authorities will deal with it. And therefore, we're kind of extrapolating what shutdowns will do in a macro sense. Do you use any of that kind of contextual analysis, or you really are just going in day to day?
No, we're still going in day to day. There are times when any macro assumption you make is a pretty much a guess anyway. All I know is that if suddenly Italian cases started to peak and followed by UK and US cases, market sentiment is going to improve significantly, and we're going to be left with a market on steroids with the central bank action we've seen already. And as we saw last year, Hamish Douglas justifying some of the very high PEs on some of the stocks he held, based upon what interest rates were. He was using a discount rate of 2.5%, saying on that basis it's perfectly okay for some of the stocks to be trading on the PEs they're trading on. Well, let's see what he does when interest rates are 0.25%. On that basis, BHP could be worth double what it is now. There is just too many assumptions going in, but I can tell you, if there is an improvement in cases, and that's if you had one central metric, it's clearly COVID cases and the exponential curve and what it's doing, and probably led by the micro experience in Italy. That is your biggest metric for timing. But if that starts to improve, we have massively oversold. And with the central bank settings we've got, the market is going to recover or is presenting a cheap moment, cheapest in the last decade anyway. And we will gauge that. We will gauge that on a daily basis. We don't have the resources to try and do detailed modelling of what this means for earnings. As I say, we're market experts, and that is probably our skill set, and we will continue to judge the market sentiment rather than take a view or try and do some probably hollow fundamental or macro analysis of what's happening, because nobody knows.
Okay, I'd just make the point that Hamish reiterated those valuation arguments the day before the market collapsed. So, so I mean, I actually buy, you know, most of those valuation arguments myself, but there are examples of where, you know, this kind of zero interest rate environment didn't deliver such high valuations, such as in Japan. So there are assumptions behind that as well. My question is then, on your view, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, this, if that's the rocket fuel for the market going forward, and, you know, as crazy as it might seem, our fundamental view of macro, which is, you know, one of our expertise, is that the virus shock owing to the shutdowns is already, you know, hugely material and will be immense before we get to reopen things. And therefore, the shock to earnings is equally immense. We can't quantify it. We just know it'll be big. How do you see a red hot market, as you describe, kind of catapulting itself over such an enormous valley? Is it plausible?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a slap in the face to Hamish Douglas's arguments about PEs. Essentially, zero interest rates. I think there's an inflection point where interest rate cuts, as we all inwardly know, have become futile, and in fact inject more uncertainty in everyone, from consumers to investors, than they add confidence. Also, there's an assumption through this that everybody's got debt or is prepared to take out debt. So you lower interest rates, they'll take out more. Well, they won't. There comes a point where people start to think there must be something really wrong for interest rates to be where they are. And the obvious conclusion, although people don't know it, is there is something wrong. And what's wrong is that the world's in balance. What zero interest rates or negative interest rates are telling you is that people are going to pay you to borrow money. Why would they do that? I'll tell you why they'd do that, because you're going to lose money by investing it. So zero interest rates, you know, be it in the housing market or shares or whatever, but zero interest rates is a siren telling you something is deeply wrong. And as we know in Japan, they had 25 years of going down 5.46% per annum compound in the stock market because they couldn't get rid of deflation. The same thing is happening here. So no, not for an instance do I believe that zero interest rate is going to put the stock market on fire. But the monetary settings, as we come out of this, are far better than they were at the top. I felt for a long time that one of the big mistakes in the US is, ever since the GFC, Bernanke, followed by Yellen, who introduced us to not a doves and hawks, but chickens, perpetuated by Powell, is this idea that suddenly, since the GFC, the central banks, or the Federal Reserve in particular, have a priority for their monetary policy settings, which is to protect the financial markets. Prior to the GFC, the financial markets were seen as the barometer of central bank success or economic success or failure. They allowed them to fail and they allowed the stock market to fall. Now they don't want to do that. And then you've had 2-3 years here of Trump pushing that even harder, telling us that the stock market is how fabulous it is, and you're welcome. He sends out a message at Christmas like it's his responsibility. They have started caring about the financial markets, and that's super dangerous because it means that we're mollycoddled along, and there is something seriously wrong about zero interest rates for the economy and consumers, but there's something seriously dangerous about central banks constantly supporting the financial markets, because it can only end one way, and this isn't it. But coming out the other side of this, I'd be very suspicious of the markets in general.
So if Donald Trump was to give you, you know, a call and, you know, tap you on the shoulder and ask you to be the new Paul Volcker, what would you do as Federal Reserve Chair?
I would unfortunately I would cause a crash because I would say the stock market is no longer our concern. You're on your own, and on that day the market would drop 45%. Then have a think about it. Then do some earnings assessments and go, actually, I'll pay this price. And the central banks have got to get away from constantly providing. They've gone from trying to look after an economy and managing inflation to their priority, especially with Trump, is to look after the financial markets. And that is a disastrous manipulation that can't continue long term and is going to have some consequences at some point. Obviously, not yet.
Mm. Do you think that Trump can get re-elected and that regime persist, or do you think the Dems or
up until February the 20th, he was going to romp home, wasn't he? I think you'll find he's a little bit like Pauline Hanson. There's an unbelievable undercurrent of support that is not palatable, but is real. And I think he will probably romp home. We're all judging him, but the reality is he's made some very strident moves in the last few years. You talk about how could he do this tweeting, but the reality is 20 years of negotiation with integrity behind closed doors, trying to pull back China since it joined the WTO. And started to devastate U.S. manufacturing industries. They have been trying to pull that back, and no one did anything about it behind closed doors, negotiating as they should have done with integrity. Trump created a show out of it, and through threatening the worst-case scenarios, he has managed to move the needle on China. And I don't think you can underestimate out of the fake man that you see before you, a mild genius might be luck in what he has managed to achieve. And I think he'll find no competitor on the Democrats or even amongst the Republicans who people will get behind. So I think he's going to romp back in.
Hmm. Well, I'm of the view that history will actually only remember Trump for his China stance. And we'll probably remember him quite favourably on that front. So I probably agree, though I worry that his somewhat chaotic response to the pandemic is going to do him some serious harm if the death rate gets too high in the US.
It's definitely not helping him, is it? This is cutting little chunks out of him, but I don't think it's cutting him down.
I was just saying, so far I think the polls are actually quite positive for him. Yeah, it's surprising. Yes.
Well, I mean, the death rate's pretty low still, so we'll see. So, Marcus, do you see, while we're sort of on the big picture topics, any other, sort of large structural changes coming out of this virus experience? I guess specifically, certainly globally, but specifically for the Australian economy and Australian assets?
Yes, I think the legacy of this will be people will understand that the banks are ex-growth and because they just don't have any margins with zero interest rates. They haven't had them, people have been getting onto this for a couple of years, but with zero rates, they cannot maintain their dividends. And finally, the Australian population might wake up to the fact that pursuing franked dividends is a money-losing activity the franked dividends are getting smaller, but because they are missing out on what the stock market is really for, which is for growth. If you talk to an American, bonds are for income, although they're not really anymore, and equities are for growth. And they've always had that mindset. That's why people like Microsoft and Berkshire Hathaway resisted for years paying any dividends, because if they've got 20% return on equity, put the money back into the company and they'll make you another 20%. Don't pay it out to shareholders who haven't got a clue what to do and invest it in a bond at 2%. So we need to get our head around the idea that the Australian interest in franking credits, because they think it's some sort of freebie. It's actually castrating their returns, because it's corralling them into dull, low-growth stocks. Finally, maybe coming out of this, we might break this mold of Australian investors sticking their money in these boring stocks. But I think the banks losing their, of course you must hold them status, would be one thing. The other thing I think is quite interesting coming out is, I don't know about you, but working at home ain't too bad. And I'm not sure I want to work with all my colleagues every day. I wouldn't be, you know, if you held commercial property, mate, it peaked on February the 20th. You know, we ain't coming back. So that could redefine a few things, which has, if people do get their heads around the technology in the next couple of months, goodness, you know, all sorts of things change, transport, rents, office space. Anyway, I think that could be a bit of a legacy of this. But the other thing I think will be people need to look at the market for growth. And there are a lot of growth stocks in our market that are fabulous. And that you need to move away from your four banks, Telstra, BHP and Rio, and perhaps have a look at what really is on offer. Because we see some portfolios of individual investors here. We do portfolio assessments. Some of them are just fabulous. And the ones that are fabulous are the ones that throw off that diversified portfolio Buffett-esque bullshit and focus on stocks they want to buy and want to wake up to. And maybe coming out of this, people can clean out and reassess, because there's a lot of really dull investment in Australia by people without imagination who don't want to have to think. And they're now, yeah, 50% of some portfolios are in now very low growth, and you might just find low yielding stocks as well.
Mm. So do you focus on small and mid caps yourself then, looking for that growth?
No, not necessarily. Mid caps have become very dangerous. The results season is like walking around on a battlefield in an orange vest. You're never quite during an artillery barrage. You never know when you're going to get blown up by these mid cap companies. So you can significantly reduce the risk. For instance, Macquarie. You know, Macquarie, how many employees they got? 8,000 or something? 8,000 of the smartest people in Australia with one goal in mind, which is to make money out of everybody else. I think that's probably worth investing in, for instance. And there are lots of other companies with basic drivers that are going in the right direction. That are worth looking at in a zero interest rate environment. For instance, Transurban was hitting all time highs last year on the back of interest rates falling until they bottomed, and now again, Transurban, Sydney Airport, if we can get over this travel thing, they're going to have perfect conditions with the amount of debt that they've got, and with real estate investment trusts have got as well. Come the conclusion of this fear moment, their conditions are perfect for them. Lower interest rates are as good as an earnings upgrade for them. So some of the REITs, some of the infrastructure utility stocks are going to benefit out of this at the end of the day.
They sound more like natural monopolies than they do growth plays, though.
Well, it depends how you define growth, really.
Yes, true, it does. I mean, monopoly pricing is a good start.
Yeah, maybe I've lost my focus. I'm thinking about growth in share price. Excuse me for that, as opposed to high return on equity. But in zero interest rates, you know, stocks that yield 4.5% with reliable return on equity of 5 to 10% suddenly become sexy.
Yeah.
Because they're more sexy than bonds. The other, which I would say for you guys, oh, you're probably not your field, but there's a tremendous opportunity here in hybrids as well. Most of the hybrids have gone from a dollar to 85 cents. In the GFC, some of them went to 25 cents. Macquarie's went to, I think, 40 cents in the dollar. AMP as well. And they all came back to par. Nobody missed a payment. Nobody defaulted. There is, for a conservative investor, there's a free 10 to 15% sitting there in hybrids, just assuming we don't get a next leg down, everything goes horrible. But because there are significant risks of the hybrids, but that's another opportunity, I think. Here.
Do you nudge your way into fixed interest, or are you?
No. Our fund is by nature supposed to be aggressive. It's not really aggressive for an equities person, but it's aggressive in industry standards. When you're talking about large industry funds, for instance, it's aggressive because it's all equities. We run an income fund as well, and we looked at the hybrids option, but we decided not to. There's more money to be made elsewhere, which is why we wouldn't do it. But it is probably, for the conservative and particularly very conservative people, one of the best risk reward trades out there that's been created.
I think Marcus, we would push back a little bit on the very conservative, actually, and even on the conservative part for the hybrids. But I think there's a whole discussion there in terms of how much risk it is. But I'll leave back to you, David.
My question that all my readers will want to ask, of course, is, you know, if you think hybrids are a good bet, then you're probably not particularly concerned about the Australian property market and its potential to upset the banks.
Smoothing over the inherent risks in hybrids and the complexity and the fact that you really could lose 100% of your capital despite the fact they're presenting themselves as a sort of bond. That's not the point at all. My point is short term, which is you've got hybrids trading at 90 cents or 85 cents because they think the NAB will go bust. I think that is out of whack. The risk is out of whack for the reward on offer. When this settles down, these are all going to be back to a dollar. It's a trade. It's not a view on hybrids at all.
And I think so. The other thing I'd actually like to add, sorry, David, could I just add in quickly that I think there's almost a behavioural element to this anyway, in terms of saying if these hybrids were owned by institutional investors only, then I'd be saying then they'd be priced a lot lower. But I think there's this feeling in the background that because so many retail investors are invested in these and don't understand the risks, that if something goes wrong and one of the banks does fall over and they need to be bailed out, is that chances are the government might be bailing out the hybrids as well. And so there's sort of there's almost that option where I'm sure, given the risk profile and what they're meant to be, if they're just wholesale investors, they shouldn't be getting the money back. But just the fact that so many retail investors own it, and broadly, and so many stockbrokers push it as being, hey, this is a good thing for people to buy, for conservative investors to buy. That's my effect, is it's almost, because it's been pushed so hard, governments might need almost to bail it out because the weight of voter power will be too high.
Well, let's be honest about hybrids, right? Hybrids of when you're getting paid 1% to push a hybrid that you know will walk out of the door as a broker, it is money for jam. And they will not say a bad word about it. And the more brokers that they get selling the hybrid, which they would only need one. My grandmother could sell the next NAB hybrid. They only need, by involving all the brokers, they can't write any research. Everybody's going to sell the hybrids and they're going to all get to 1%. And in a dull corporate market, it's just a wonderful thing when you are a big broker and you hear NAB's doing a new hybrid or ANZ or whoever it is. It's money for jam.
Wonderful for the broker, not the client.
Yeah. Let's also tell you the big lie about hybrids which is retail investors are ignoring, most of them are equity investors. They're used to quite a high level of risk, and they are ignoring the inherent risk in hybrids. And people are sucked in because they are sucked in feeling like it's a risk-free return, or like it is in a bond. It's clearly not. But equity investors go, ah, I don't care about that. All I can see is that I'm going to get, you know, what is it, 3.5% a month ago. It's now 4.5% to 5% yield out of it. The big lie about hybrids is that most of the people that buy it are used to a quite high level of risk, and they just go, this is very low risk from what I'm used to, and I want a higher yield. So yes, but there are big inherent risks in it. We all know that. Let's not pretend. Everything's great. Everything does what it says on the box, as long as you don't get threats to the issuer existence. We've got a bit of a threat at the moment. If suddenly we relax, that's an opportunity for a trade, but it doesn't change the fact that hybrids are, in the eyes of a fixed interest expert, terrible investments because the risk is much bigger than they are used to in the fixed interest market, and the yield doesn't compensate you for them. And it's the same with any corporate bond. The further you go down the issuer credibility, the yield gets incrementally higher for exponentially higher risk. One of the truths of fixed interest, but don't let me blow an industry up with the truth.
That's all right. We don't invest in any corporate bonds for that reason, just because we have that view as well that you're basically getting, you know, all the upside of bonds with all the downsides of equities in most of these things.
So. Yeah, I know. Fixed interest people, fixed interest experts know exactly what's going on here. The risk-reward ratio is completely wrong for them. It offends their natural sense of risk and return.
Yeah. Now, given the time, you know, I don't want to take too much more of your time, but what I'd love to hear before you go is, so you've gone all in at the moment, and sort of, as you said, you're waking up every day and seeing what it is. So what are the key signs you're looking for now that's going to flip your the dial back the other way?
In a world of unknowns, it will be probably more technical than fundamental. It'll be a combination. It'll be the markets tipping over. Corrections start fast. If we get another precipitous drop, we'll probably bail again, because it will be the technical sign that people have assessed the fundamentals and realized this is going to get another leg down. We're not going to do that on 1-3% falls over the next few days. I think we're due a leveling out period, but it will be, as I say, some precipitous development that we'll wake up to and make a decision. And I can't really tell you what that will be.
Yeah. I don't think we have 1-3% days anymore, do we? I can't remember the last time.
Well, if I can say that was great, guys. Thanks very much. Let's just hope we're all here to have another one in a month's time.
Well done.
Sounds great.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mark. Thanks for coming on. We'll get you on soon. Cheers.
So, look, a lot of interesting things that Marcus had to say. I think there's probably, I'll probably reiterate again, there's some very big differences in terms of the way we run the portfolios. And I think as Marcus you sort of probably gathered from what he was saying, he's sort of been from quite fully invested to 100% cash last year, back to fully invested, back to 70% cash for a lot of this crisis, and then flat back to fully invested, probably turning the portfolio over maybe 4 or 5 times, I'm not quite sure of the count, over the last year. Our target's to turn over about a third of our portfolio in any one year. This year's been a big year for us. We've done a lot more than that because we did a big flip. But we're certainly not trying to time the market on all the ups and downs. And within bear markets, you certainly get, and I think Marcus was acknowledging, you know, we're in a bear market, but you will get these big rallies. And But if you're in a bear market, the general trend is down. And so he's done quite well at sort of picking the current rally. From our perspective, I think there's obviously two sides to trying to pick these rallies. You got to get in and you got to get out. And so there's a and if you in the current markets, you know, there's 10% up, 10% down within a day or two of each other. And so you do need to be very nimble. You do need to be right on top of the technical sides of it. And given our portfolios are global, we run, you know, cash in pretty much every developed country. We have stocks within those countries. It's not something we can flip in and flip out as easily. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're sort of trying to take a longer term strategic view at these. So, I mean, the things that we're quite keen to look for is when we start seeing traders who are coming up with quite fundamental reasons why we should be turning things around and why things will be better. As Marcus said, he's really trading on the feel of this market at the moment and his take on the sentiment and the technicals. I think it's interesting to note how heavily he is looking at the case counts. And I think that's quite similar. I think there's a lot of people in the markets who are looking very heavily at case counts. And I do think you'll find, as he's saying, you know, when the case counts start to slacken off and you get this sign that there's going to be a turn, there will be definitely be a bear market rally within that, where traders everywhere are like, right, it's all over with, you know, solution solved and off they go in. My concern is that we haven't even started the economic impacts yet. As Marcus was saying, companies, we haven't seen the company earnings get cut yet. We know they're going to be down a lot, but we don't know how far because we're only 3 weeks in, or 4 weeks into this whole scenario. So any companies are really only just seeing the very start of it themselves. The unemployment has definitely spiked a lot. And one of the key things I'd like just want to highlight with unemployment is unemployment isn't V-shaped. The whole process behind government stimulus package, especially early government stimulus package at the moment, is to try and make sure that companies hang on to employees. Because if companies can hang on to employees during this downturn, then you do get a much sharper lift out of it because they don't have to go through that whole hiring process. But if you do get a big spike in unemployment, there's sort of two factors that stops it from coming back quite quickly. The first factor is it takes a while for people to hire. There is a, especially if you've got a workforce which isn't fully employed as will likely be. So let's say you're a restaurant owner, you've just laid off 10 of your staff, you've kept two or three of them to keep a sort of skeleton going and something there. So when demand does start to pick up, you probably won't go back to hiring all 10 of them straight away. It'll be quite a slow process of, right, I might hire two or three straight away and then push those guys out to full time and overtime, and then okay, they're now starting to work as much as possible. Okay, now I'll go and add another one, and then wait till we're filled up again, and then go and add another one. It won't be straight away going back and hiring those people. So that's one side of it. Oh, sorry, and also within that hiring process, especially for larger companies, it's a longer process. It takes a while to hire somebody to make sure you're finding the right person. And managers have just been through this whole process of having to sack people, and it's not a nice process for either party. And as a manager, they generally don't want to repeat that. So if they can hold off for a little bit longer until they're certain, so that they don't have to go through that process of firing people, I think that's what you'll find they will do. So there's that hiring side. And then the other part is the spending. Is the part on behalf of people who have been laid off. And a lot of studies have really shown that when you lay off people, particularly older employees, quite likely they will never go back to the workforce, or they will never go back in anywhere near the same capacity as what they were. And so what it means is that the people who are being hired are usually younger and less experienced, and there's a learning curve. And you do have this cohort of people who are going to be long-term unemployed. And so our expectation isn't that you get a V-shaped recovery bounce out of this. And so I think from what we could tell from what Marcus was looking at, certainly there were it seemed to be a largely sentiment driven and on the basis of technicals. I think we're happier to wait in terms of our own trading and until we actually do see some more solid signs about what's happening on the corporate debt markets in particular, seeing those open up and actually starting to see how bad the unemployment's going to get. At the moment, it looks like it's going to be very bad, and we don't think it's going to flip around quickly. but maybe that'll change with stimulus measures. Maybe it won't. Having said that, one of the key points you did bring out, you do need to expect a big rally when the deaths start to slow, and it will be quick. Like, they'll be on top of this in terms of saying, hey, there's signs that deaths are slowing in Italy and the US and a few others, and then markets will rally quite quickly. We're expecting that'll only be, again, a short-term bounce before you see the economic impact really start to take effect. So I guess the main thing I'd like to sort of impress upon people, anyone who would like to follow Marcus's trading and sort of jump into the market, is to really sort of be careful and pay attention to the reasons why he's doing it, not just the words itself. So, for my part, the reasons were very much that it's a timing mechanism, it's a sentiment mechanism, and they're sort of sitting on top of that as traders trying to time that in and out of the market. From our perspective, we do have much broader portfolios in some ways. So he can buy basically anything he wants on the ASX, or he can stick his money in cash. We have the benefit of being able to put into government bonds and international equities and international cash, and that gives us, however, we can't buy all the small stocks. We can only buy the large cap stocks. So we're very limited in some ways compared to what he can do, but in other ways we've got much broader. And we're pretty happy that you're taking a broader view on some of these. We'll see that our currencies will get beaten down one day, while at the same time our equities are performing, sort of lifting the other part of the portfolio, and the net effect is actually not very much in the overall portfolio. And in conditions like today, and while we think we're still in a bear market, we're pretty happy with that as an outcome. Not trying to pick the bottoms and pick the sort of local bottoms and local tops, but more play that broader trend. So very different. And the other thing as well, we did speak about hybrids, but I also just want to highlight, that there are significant risks in hybrids, and while Marcus spoke about that as being a potential opportunity, it certainly is for traders. Our strong view for longer term investors is, unless you've got certainty that you're going to get a government bailout, or certainty about backstops in terms of what's going to happen with them, is that they're quite a high risk area of the market, and we certainly would be a lot of places put them into fixed interest. They're not fixed interest. You're running much larger risks within those. And as a final comment, I think Marcus didn't actually say this directly, but I think it's certainly implied in the way he's reacting, and very similar to what we're doing, is one of the key things at the moment is being liquid is very important. Whatever you're doing, straying into illiquid assets at the moment, like private equities or some of the corporate debt markets, or indeed housing, or any property at the moment, is they're sort of long-term assets that aren't liquid, take a number of months to get out of it, and you will see lockups in those funds. And so, as he said, uncertainty is extremely high at the moment, and you do need to be nimble, and you do need to be have liquid assets at this point in the cycle.
Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.